Hello, this is Elton Banks for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And so, as usual, we'll dive into the biz page from this week's Triangle Business Journal. And as usual, we have about five or six short articles here, so we'll begin by the article, How Kane's Owner Connected with Mavs' Mark Cuban. The more we talk to the new Carolina Hurricanes owner, Tom Dundon, the more interesting tidbits we find out. While you may notice Dundon, who has a six handicap, teeing it up this weekend with former Dallas Cowboys starting quarterback Tony Romo and pro golfer Hunter Mahan at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am on national TV, what you may not know is that Dundon is quite close to Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. Dundon says he played basketball with Cuban at least twice a week and has kept in touch with him ever since. In fact, Cuban was the reason Dundon's wife, Verushka, moved to Dallas when they were dating. I told Mark that she needs a job. At that time, she was working for Yahoo in Silicon Valley. Dundon recalls, it all worked out in the end. Dundon says he has no plans to buy a house in the Raleigh area right now. The Umstead Hotel is great and works for me, says the 47-year-old. As for other family matters, Dundon says he's trying to convince one of his kids to go to Duke University or UNC Chapel Hill. We'll see how that goes, he says with a smile. And under the heading of Fresh Idea comes the article, Entrepreneurs Find Success with Krebs. Brett DeVries has been in the restaurant business for 30 years, even owning six Jimmy John's in the Wilmington area. But when his business partner, Jason Cox, suggested opening a coffee shop in Graham, DeVries was underwhelmed. I said, well, coffee shops are really hard. It's hard to beat the monster. So we need to do something a little different than a coffee shop. He said, how about if we try Krebs? That could be fun. So the investors pumped in a little less than $200,000 to start Press Coffee and Krebs. Using Simple Order to help analyze the menu, Press is doing about 1,500 plates in a 28-day period and looking to the Triangle to expand. DeVries said Press is using some of the same tactics Jimmy John's mastered, that is, keep the food simple, tasty, and fast. Now in the article under the heading of Connecting is the article, New Duke Law Leader Sees Opportunities. Technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship will be the focus when Carrie Adams, takes over as the new dean of the Duke University School of Law on July 1. Abrams, the vice provost of faculty affairs and professor of law at the University of Virginia, is replacing David Levi, who retires in June. I'm interested in making sure that we really focus on that intersection with the rest of the university and the region, and thinking about technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship, particularly in terms of course offerings, as well as clinical and public service training, Abrams says. That includes legal clinics that provide services to residents of Durham and surrounding areas, and training lawyers to be in public service areas. The opportunity at Duke was attractive, she says, because of the possibilities of expanding even further the interconnections between the law school and the rest of the university. And under the heading of Irked Trump comes the article, Deputy Attorney General to Speak at Campbell Law. A Justice Department leader who has been in President Donald Trump's crosshairs over the Russia investigation is coming to the Triangle. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein will deliver the commencement address at Campbell's Law School's graduation ceremony May the 11th. Rosenstein, who oversees Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, is a Harvard University law graduate and has a connection to a Campbell faculty member. Campbell Law Dean J. Rich Leonard said, Rosenstein is a dedicated public servant, and we are delighted that a lawyer of his prominence can join us for this commencement. And under the heading of Downtown comes the article, Mapping a New Future for the Core of Raleigh. The new head of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance has some short and some long-term plans as he plunges into his role as a key leader in the city. Chris Larson, who grew up in Raleigh, began as CEO this month, and a part of his job is listening to stakeholders and building future opportunities. But already, Larson sees ways to improve downtown. One, he says, is simple, beautification. So there's some things that we can start doing immediately, he says. He also sees opportunities when it comes to mobility, that is, how to help relieve stress points related to traffic with existing resources and infrastructure. Another role for the DRA, he says, is one of inclusion. Not all citizens in our community are enjoying Raleigh's very significant run economically. There are some opportunities for our organization to step out and demonstrate some leadership in that space. To better answer the question, who's downtown for? He also says Raleigh needs to preserve the character of our place as it moves forward, and thus not losing the identity that made it so desirable in the first place. Larson will speak at the DRA's annual meeting on February the 15th at the Raleigh Convention Center. Landscape architect Michael Van Valkenburg, whose firm is leading the Dix Park project, also will speak, and participants will have a chance to give their input on the project. And finally, on the biz page for this week, under the heading of Job Seeker, comes the article, Wake County's Pitch Hinges on Talent. Amazon, are you listening? The commercial real estate market is paying keen attention as Wake County pursues new corporations. So a recent meeting of CoreNet, a local industry group, leaned forward and listened recently when the executive director of Wake County Economic Development visited. Michael Haley took CoreNet through a pitch deck that his group, an arm of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, uses when it's promoting the region to companies. And while Haley didn't get into specifics, it was obvious the chance for Amazon's second headquarters was on everyone's mind. I don't have a giant checkbook in my car, he said, explaining that the market had plenty to sell it, led by talent. That's what this place is, he said. Talent is the driver. The Triangle has some clear drawbacks compared to others. For example, the Triangle is not an airport hub. It's what it is, he said, and lacks mass transit. What we have to become is more public transit oriented, he said. But the Triangle also doesn't have some of the drawbacks of others, he added, specifically referring to how Silicon Valley can be, quote, a bloodbath, unquote. I don't want to be the next Silicon Valley, he said. We are an authentic community. We are who we are. Now turning to the On Technology and EcoDevo page of this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the heading Expansion. And the article is Frontier Airlines Adding Nonstop Flights from RDU. Denver-based Frontier Airlines is making an aggressive expansion at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The carrier is adding flights to several destinations, including Houston, San Antonio, Buffalo, New York, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, all but Houston, currently served by both United Airlines and Southwest Airlines, are routes on RDU's top unserved markets list. The company previously announced flights to Providence, Rhode Island, and Kansas City, Missouri, set to begin this spring. Already, Frontier has 7 nonstop services on RDU's flight map, including a recently launched flight to Austin, Texas. And under the heading of Emerging Issue comes the article, Finding Talent Concerns Local Business Leaders. At NC State University's 2018 Emerging Issues Forum on February the 5th, executives told the crowd to lobby lawmakers for more education funding, the only way to fight the STEM gap, they said. Every day, we're hearing from our recruiters that we have jobs available, but we don't have the workforce available with the appropriate skills to fill those jobs, said Vanessa Harrison, president of AT&T North Carolina. It takes us quite often 2 years or more to fill some of these positions. We have a saying that a lot of times we're always on the lookout for a unicorn, and when a unicorn walks past, we'll grab him and bring him on in, because there just aren't that many of them, said Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS Institute. There are a lot of folks competing for that talent, said Jim Hansen, regional president of PNC Bank. Governor Roy Cooper said one way to pay for increases in education funding is to block more planned tax cuts, breaks he says are unnecessary, and by the state's already low corporate taxes. And under the heading of Encouraged comes the article, Lenovo Execs Tout Transformation. Lenovo, which has its dual headquarters in Morrisville, announced a $289 million loss in the quarter ending in December. Executives pointed to a $400 million charge related to the new U.S. tax bill. The write-off does not have any impact on our operations, and we believe a lower U.S. corporate tax rate will benefit our corporations, our operations in the U.S. over time, Chief Financial Officer Wal Ming Wong said on an earnings call. CEO Yuan King Yang told analysts on the call that Lenovo had delivered on a statement he made last quarter, and that the firm had entered a new phase of growth. "We have delivered not only our commitment, but also our best results in this fiscal year," he said, noting that the revenue, nearly $13 billion, was the highest in 3 years. The transformation in the data center group, which is based in Research Triangle Park, is making progress faster than expected, he said. While Yang said Lenovo still needs to sharpen its high-end segment position in North America, data center volume in the region outgrew the market by 90 points year over year. And Kirk Scoggin, the RTP-based head of the data center group, told analysts the firm is on track, and perhaps slightly ahead, and is planned to be a number one supercomputer company by 2020. And under the heading of public records comes the article, Chatham had a backup plan for auto deal. Public records from the North Carolina Department of Commerce show Chatham County had a backup plan when it came to its pursuit of Toyota Mazda. By the end of September, the automakers had focused their North Carolina site search squarely on the Greensboro-Randolph megasite, rejecting the Moncure megasite and the Chatham-Siler City Advanced Manufacturing site, both of which had initially been in the running. An email recapping one of several site visits by Toyota executive hints at why. The client now sees Liberty as having a slight edge over Siler City due to its proximity of Greensboro and the various amenities and quality of life attributes. Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, wrote September the 15th. By October, state correspondence about the plant stops mentioning Chatham County. But Chatham County wasn't finished, says Kyle Touchstone, president of the Chatham Economic Development Corporation. Instead, Chatham County switched its own focus to recruiting suppliers that could one day support a Toyota Mazda plant in Liberty. In an interview, Touchstone says that had been the game plan all along for both Chatham and Greensboro-Randolph. If one of us were to land it, the suppliers and such could take advantage of the neighboring site, he says. Records show he had state support, as North Carolina put forward a sample auto supplier project initiatives memo to start that recruitment process. A theoretical 300-job project, investing $100 million to support the automobile manufacturer, could be in line for up to $10.5 million in total incentives, according to a baseline chart from the Department of Commerce. And Chung proposed in an October the 8th email that the state might hold multiple supplier support seminars in Japan to help Mazda suppliers, especially since they don't have much of a footprint in the U.S., understand tax, incentive, permitting, and other issues in North Carolina. On January the 3rd, Chung wrote Secretary of Commerce Tony Copeland and the Commerce team again, saying his office had been working on a marketing outreach plan for suppliers pending positive news from Japan. While Toyota Mazda's Alabama pick squashed those efforts, the process gave Touchstone important lessons, he says. This project reinforces a company's desire to eliminate risk, he says. They have speed-to-market requirements. Now turning to the healthcare page, a couple of articles under the heading of Moving comes the article, Former Quintiles IMS COO Joins C-Suite at Liquidia. Former Quintiles IMS Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Kevin Gordon has joined Morrisville-based Liquidia Technologies as the company's new President and Chief Financial Officer. Prior to his role at COO at Quintiles IMS, where he oversaw global operations and contributed to the mega merger between Quintiles and IMS Health, Gordon served as Executive Vice President and CFO at Quintiles from 2010 to 2015. He held that same title at Teleflex before joining Quintiles. Gordon says that after a very successful run at Quintiles, he was looking for a new opportunity and challenge, one that was much more entrepreneurial in nature. Through natural networks here in the Triangle, Gordon says that he connected with Liquidia's CEO Neil Fowler and other members of the company. Ultimately, Liquidia's print technology focused on particle technology for more effective drug delivery, was particularly attractive due to its broad use across many platforms, he says. And under the heading of More Beds, the article, UNC Health opens the Nash Cancer Center. After starting construction roughly a year ago, Nash UNC Healthcare has opened its new cancer center. The Danny Talbot Cancer Center in Rocky Mount is designed to bring services for residents of Nash County and surrounding areas, including an oncology clinic, radiation therapy, and infusion therapy under one roof. We started conversations truly because we saw a large percentage of patients were leaving the community because they were not finding comprehensive services, said Sterling Grimes, Director of Cancer Services at Nash UNC Healthcare. This has taken place over the last 10 years, she says, with plans officially put in motion in November of 2014 with board approval. Nash Healthcare began an affiliation agreement with UNC Healthcare in April of 2014. According to Nash UNC Healthcare, the new cancer center was a $7 million project which was funded without acquiring debt. The center is named for former Rocky Mount senior high school star Danny Talbot, who excelled in football, baseball, and basketball, and played all three sports at UNC Chapel Hill. Talbot was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 2010. At the new cancer center, there are 10 examination rooms in the oncology clinic, 14 semi-private bays in the infusion center for chemotherapy treatments, and 2 linear accelerators for radiation treatment. The cancer center can see about 45 patients a day, says Grimes. The new center is in the final stage of a 10-year strategic growth plan for Nash Healthcare. In the last year, Nash UNC Healthcare appointed oncologist Dr. Davina Alston Johnson as medical director of the new center, notes Grimes, and expects to add an additional oncologist later this year. Additional health professionals and staff bring the new cancer center's headcount to about 35, according to Grimes. While there's not a genetic counselor on site, patients can access one remotely through telemedicine. The Nash Healthcare Foundation also manages an assistance fund. According to Grimes, about 20% of our patients need some sort of financial assistance with their care. Just last month, Nash UNC Healthcare announced Lee Isley, CEO of Granville Health Systems, as its new president and CEO, replacing Dr. Ian Buchanan, who had served as the interim since September. The Danny Talbot Cancer Center in Rocky Mount is part of UNC's ongoing commitment to providing high-quality cancer care closer to home for patients across North Carolina, Buchanan said in an email. Now moving to this week's On Real Estate page. Under the heading of Sold comes the article, Florida Firm Buys Wake Forest Apartments and Nearby Land. A Florida investment firm has scooped up a new 214-unit apartment community in Wake Forest and an adjacent 7-acre parcel that could one day be home to more residential development. Waypoint Residential of Boca Raton paid $36.4 million for the Capitol Creek at Heritage Complex, located along Rogers Road near its intersection with Heritage Branch Road. The sale works out to $170,000 per unit. The complex was completed in 2016 by two Capital Partners of Georgia and cost $25.8 million to develop, according to the firm's website. Waypoint has other investments in the Triangle and had been looking to expand its presence here even further. And under the heading of Hot Market comes the article, Number of Real Estate Firms on the Rise. Sometimes it pays to strike out on your own as a real estate agent. At least that might be the mindset that's led to a proliferation of real estate firms. In mid-2017, the number of companies licensed with the North Carolina Real Estate Commission surpassed the pre-recession total. Today, there are 11,828 companies selling homes, according to the North Carolina Real Estate Commission. The last time that number of firms was close to that large was in 2007, when the tally reached 11,375. At that time, the average number of brokers per firm in North Carolina was 9.57. Today, that number has dropped to 7.66. Broker Debbie Van Horn of Fonville Morrissey attributes that to the increase in boutique real estate companies. A lot of people are trying to stay away from some of the larger firms, generally to make more money, Van Horn says. And Kathy Beecham of Coldwell Banker Howard Perry and Walston says, when I'm out showing properties, I see signs I've never heard of. The benefits of working for a larger company are many, they say, and include name recognition, more marketing muscle, and tech support. But that doesn't stop people from breaking out on their own. A lot of them are the smaller local companies, so that they can capitalize on the marketplace and the commission splits, Van Horn says. The residential real estate market continues to be a hot commodity. The total dollar volume of sales in the Triangle has grown each year since 2011 and jumped 13% from 2016 to 2017 alone. While the number of firms in the state has climbed past the previous high, the number of brokers in North Carolina has yet to reach that milestone. There were 90,553 brokers in the 2017 data, and in 2007 there were just under 100,000. The total number of agents who are members of the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors surpassed the pre-recession high in 2016 and reached 7,742 last year. In 2007, the previous high, the total number of agents was 6,999. And a couple more articles on the real estate front. Under the heading of Cary Move comes the article, Barnes & Noble Building in Cary Sells for $7 Million. Barnes & Noble has been seeing a decline in sales for years, but the building across from the Cary Town Center that houses the brick-and-mortar book giant found one highly interested buyer and recently sold for $7.09 million. The 40,000-square-foot building sits on 4.42 acres at 760 Southeast Maynard Road. The new owner, MDO Holdings, doesn't have any immediate plans to redevelop, despite all the plans for development in the area. CBL Properties, owner of Cary Town Center, has drawn up plans that could bring multiple hotels, 600,000 square feet of office space, and 800 housing units to the shopping center located across Walnut Street from the bookstore. An IKEA also is in the works for the mall. A nearby Wegmans-anchored mixed-use development called Fenton received a rezoning approval last month. While Barnes & Noble is struggling nationwide, the Cary location was an attractive investment for MDO Holdings because of all the redevelopment activity near it, CEO Michael Olander Jr. says. With all the new developments online in this part of Cary, we believe this site is good core real estate and are pleased to add it to our portfolio, he says. We look forward to continuing to invest in the growth of our Triangle communities. MDO Holdings bought it from a subsidiary of the Leon Capital Group of Texas. The firm previously bought the development for $6 million in late 2014. And under the heading of outside investment comes the article, New York firm buys RTP buildings for $135 million. A New York real estate firm has snatched up three office buildings in Research Triangle Park that are home to Lenovo, paying $135.3 million. The properties total 67 acres on Development Drive and have buildings dating to the mid-1990s that total 485,500 square feet. Sentinel Real Estate Corporation, based in Manhattan, bought the buildings from Longleaf Pine Funding Company, an entity managed by Global Securitization Services of New York. Combined, the transactions represent the most expensive acquisition to come through the Wake County deed records thus far in 2018 and would have ranked second in 2017 behind only the $141.9 million sale of the Hawk Plaza 1 building in Durham in December. Longleaf Pine Funding previously purchased the properties for $127 million in 2015. The most recent sale is an $8.25 million jump over the entity's initial investment 3 years ago, representing a 6.5% increase. Cushman & Wakefield brokers David Finger and Sarah Owen represented the seller in the transaction. Now we turn to the Around the State page, and the article, Carolina's Healthcare Flips Name, still chases UNC. Goodbye, Carolina's healthcare system. Hello Atrium Health. The Charlotte-based healthcare system debuted its new moniker February the 7th. It's a strategic move that better reflects Atrium Health's mission and allows for potential growth into system in the Southeast, says Gene Woods, president and chief executive. This will continue to elevate our reputation nationwide, he says. The name positions Atrium Health to create next-generation partnerships, such as its potential deal with UNC Health, which says that the deal remains in negotiations, and he anticipates a decision in the next 60 days. The change provides opportunities to expand the healthcare system's footprint to serve more communities, build economies of scale, and recruit top talent, Woods adds. The healthcare system worked with a national branding firm over the last year to whittle down 100-plus name choices. The Atrium Health name has multiple meanings. Topping the list is that an atrium is literally where every heartbeat begins, Woods says. It's also a place where connections are made. People gather, and it's filled with light. It was important for us to have a real name. We wanted something that meant something, Woods says, that kept rising to the top. The system became Carolina's healthcare system in 1996 as its footprint expanded with facilities in Charlotte and its flagship Carolina's Medical Center. And if we look at the opportunities that we think exist in the Southeast, we need a name that better reflects our ambitions to serve more communities, Woods says. And under the heading of Bryan Residence comes the article, Historic Greensboro House for Sale. The historic Joseph and Kathleen Bryan House in Greensboro's Irving Park was listed for sale recently for $1.675 million. The 6,000-square-foot brick home, owned by the Joseph M. Bryan Foundation since 1995, hasn't been on the market since it was built for Joseph Bryan in 1935. The house was designed by Charles C. Hartman, who also designed the Jefferson Standard Building, the F.W. Woolworth store that now houses the International Civil Rights Museum, and Dudley High School, and many homes in the area. For more than a decade, the four-bedroom, five-and-a-half-bathroom house was leased to UNC Greensboro as the official chancellor's residence. Now moving to the Better World page, comes the article under the heading of Small Budget. The article is Group Protects North Carolina's Wetlands. In January, in preparing a report to the state on the environmental impact of the proposed expansion in southeast Wake County of the I-540 loop around Raleigh, the Southern Environmental Law Center asked the Carolina Wetlands Association to assess the potential impact on roughly 60 acres of wetlands it would affect. The association responded that it was concerned that plans for the proposed expansion would not adequately protect amphibians in the wetlands. And in 2016, the Triangle Greenways Council asked the association to survey land the council had purchased along the Neuse River in Wake County, identify wetlands in the area, and assess the status of the wetlands and threats to them. Promoting the protection, restoration, and enjoyment of wetlands and associated ecosystems in the Carolinas through science-based programs, education, and advocacy is the mission of the association, President Rick Savage says. Operating with an annual budget of only $3,000, the all-volunteer organization began in 2015 after the administration of former Governor Pat McCrory returned to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency funding from several grants the state had received to support wetlands research and the Division of Water Quality, Savage says, whose job as a senior environmental specialist was eliminated by that decision. From 2004 to 2009, more than 80,000 acres of coastal wetlands on average were lost each year in the U.S., up from 60,000 acres a year the previous 5 years, according to a 2013 report by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The Atlantic coast alone lost nearly 112,000 acres of wetlands in the 5 years ending in 2009, the study said. With its tiny budget, the Carolina Wetlands Association so far has focused on a wetland treasures campaign that each May has recognized five wetlands in the Carolinas, conducted tours of the sites, and published fact sheets about them on its website. The wetlands in North Carolina include Robertson Mill Pond in Wake County and Mason Farm Wetlands in Orange County. The biggest threat to wetlands are development and large-scale agriculture, Savage says. Wetlands help preserve water quality by filtering nutrients and metals used in agriculture and development. They help limit flooding and protect against rising sea levels by absorbing water. They help stabilize shorelines along streams and lakes, and they help protect critical habitats. Roughly half of endangered species in the U.S. require wetlands, Savage says, and North Carolina is home to more species of salamanders than any other state. Carolina Wetlands Association, which raises money through a year-end appeal to about 400 supporters, is developing plans to increase its fundraising so it can hire a part-time executive director and part-time business manager and development director. Wetlands help make our water cleaner, prevent property damage from flooding, and provide critical habitats to species that live in wetlands, Savage says. Now we turn to this week's cover story, and the title is, As Construction Soars, Is Oversight Falling Behind? In early November, a construction worker stepped inside a portable toilet near the end of his workday at the multi-million dollar Durham Innovation District site. Moments later, a steel beam fell 5 stories, wrecking the toilet and striking him on the head. 3 months after the accident, Jesse Zimmer, 39, is still drifting in a coma at the Shepherd Center in Atlanta, a renowned brain injury rehabilitation facility. His family and coworkers are clinging to any sign. It's just so awful, says Leanne Tilley, owner of Acme Plumbing, where Zimmer works. Right now, he's moving one eye, and he's squeezing one hand, and his family members are thrilled with the progress. Fortunately, severe workplace accidents are relatively rare in North Carolina. The North Carolina Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Division, usually referred to by the acronym NCOSH, tallied 40 workplace deaths last year. But construction remains the most dangerous industry, accounting for 17 of the total. And as the industry continues to boom across the sky, with cranes dotting city skylines from Wilmington to Asheville, a potentially troubling trend in state oversight has deepened. While construction continues to grow in North Carolina, reaching nearly $25 billion in new projects in 2017, a 67% increase since the last low in 2009, inspections have decreased. In the past 7 years, the number of state health and safety inspectors of construction sites was cut nearly in half. So has the number of serious violations found by inspectors. On the ground, this means inspectors are making fewer visits to construction sites. According to a 2017 analysis from the AFL-CIO, there are 85 federal and state OSHA inspectors in North Carolina, tasked with inspecting more than 270,000 businesses. With the current staff, it would take the agency 98 years to inspect each business just once. Despite these trends, the state says safety in the workplace has improved, pointing to employer-reported data that shows the worker injury rate has declined. But labor advocates say the rate doesn't represent what's actually happening on the ground at construction sites, where employees might be intimidated from reporting an incident. Meanwhile, workplace fatalities, a statistic that's difficult to manipulate, have remained steady. The decline in statewide inspections touches many companies, including Barnhill Construction Company, the firm managing the Innovation District construction site where Zimmer was injured. Safety officers are investigating the company, as they do after all serious workplace injuries. While findings haven't been released yet, and it could be that no one was at fault in the incident, but one thing can be said for sure at this point, the company, like many across the state, has seen fewer state inspectors in recent years. Barnhill had 9 state inspections in 2008, and the number has steadily declined since then. Last year, Barnhill had just 3 visits from state safety officers, including the one that was in response to Zimmer's injury. To some, the drop in workplace inspections and citations portend a potentially dangerous situation. It's certainly troubling, says Pat McCoy, executive director of statewide community organizing group Action NC. If there's dramatically more construction going on and the inspections are down, there's something illogical and troublesome about that. State officials and those in the industry say it's not that simple. Construction companies say they have many incentives to promote worker safety outside of the heavy regulatory hand of the government. and those charged with overseeing the state's workplace safety programs argue that it's not an issue of the state's resolve, but one of capacity. With our limited resources, there's no way we can touch every business, Deputy Commissioner of Labor Kevin Beauregard says. 2 years ago, an NCOSH report documenting the department's troubles hiring and retaining experienced health and safety inspectors began with a grim warning. The division is quickly approaching a crisis that could expose more workers to safety and health hazards potentially resulting in injuries or illnesses, the report states. Pay for safety officers was too low, the report states, and the average length of stay for new hires had sunk to less than 3 years. Training new staff can take 12 to 18 months, meaning the agency had been bleeding inspectors with on-the-job experience. At the same time, state and federal funding for the division had decreased dramatically. From 2001 to 2015, the department saw a net loss of a little more than $1 million in state funding, said Dolores Quisenberry, communications director at the State Labor Department. Federal budget allocations to state workplace safety officers had similarly dipped, dropping nationwide from $104 million in 2010 to $100 million in 2015. Last year, NCOSH requested more money to increase salaries and received a $500,000 boost. It wasn't all that we asked for, but it was more than nothing, Beauregard says. One result has been that salaries for health and safety officers have increased by about $5,000, according to information Quisenberry provided. Given the funding and staffing issues, state officials say they've tried to focus their resources on industries that are particularly dangerous and in counties that have high fatality rates and large amounts of industry activity. Construction has long been an area of focus. Building accounts for about 6% of the state's workforce, but accounts for as much as half of the workplace deaths. The state's population centers are where many of the state's efforts are aimed. The Triangle accounted for 5 construction fatalities in 2017, or 30% of the total for the state as a whole. The incidents that stick in people's minds are the dramatic accidents, such as the collapse of a scaffold in downtown Raleigh in 2015 that killed 3 men. But the list of fatalities is mostly filled with much smaller incidents that often fly under the radar. A few days before Thanksgiving, a construction worker was killed after being run over by a dump truck at a coal ash dump site in Nash County. In late December, a laborer died in Orange County after falling from a roof. In each case, the companies had not been visited by state investigators until after the incident. Because of the high fatality rate in construction, the state created a special program in 1999 aimed at homing in on the industry and focusing on at-risk regions. But even inspections conducted through the program in targeted counties have declined sharply, from just over 1,209 in 2013 to about 400 in 2016, according to state records. In recent years, the state has touted injury data compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that shows the illness and injury rate among the workplace has dropped precipitously in the last decade, from 4 incidents per 100 full-time workers in 2006 to 2.5 a decade later. And by this measure, North Carolina ranks fairly well compared with neighboring states. The state points to its partnerships with employers to provide on-the-job training, a program officials say has grown in recent years. As reason for improved injury rates in the state, despite the drastic decrease in job site inspections. Beauregard also says that while there might be fewer inspections today, those that are done are more in-depth. A rule change in 2015 required all companies to report any workplace injuries that resulted in hospitalization, and the state has focused its resources on these cases, Beauregard says. Some in the construction industry say the workplace feels like it's gotten safer in the wake of the recession. The reason, according to those in the industry, is that before the economic downturn, construction sites were filled with a lot of companies trying to capitalize on the boom, and the demand for more employees led inexperienced workers to jump in the game. Many of those actors have been weeded out, some say, and it might be that people are more cautious today. I would tend to think we have a little bit more professional workforce compared to a decade ago, says Craig Hedgepeth, Chief Operating Officer of Focus Design Builders based in Youngsville. Larger companies in particular have the resources to provide more safety training, he says. Some, such as Clancy and Thays Construction Company, say they now hold pre-installation meetings to go over potential safety issues before starting on major segments of a project, such as digging a foundation or building a roof. Company officials also say more projects today are being overseen by construction managers at risk, which means the general contractor is brought on earlier in the development process and is more familiar with the project before work begins. One of the results, according to Clancy and Thays Business Development Director Matt Chambers, has been a decline in employee injuries. It's better communication all the way around that's causing it, Chambers says. Still, Chambers and others in the industry say they weren't aware that safety inspections and violations had dropped across the state. It's a bit of a surprise to me, says Bill Stricker, Vice President of Operations at the Carolinas Associated General Contractors of America. His organization makes safety trainings available to its 760 members and has a committee specifically devoted to workplace safety. Many in the industry say companies have a number of incentives outside of state citations to keep workers safe. Workers' compensation insurance rates, for example, go up if a company's accident rate goes up. Labor advocates doubt injury data that suggests the construction industry is getting safer as state oversight wanes. The injury and illness data cited by NCOSH is provided by the federal government and is self-reported by a sample of employers across the state. Workers' compensation claims across all industries reported to the North Carolina's Industrial Commission show a different trend, with the number of claims increasing significantly from 2008 to 2015, then dipping for the past 2 years. Another study put together by labor advocates surveyed construction workers in major metropolitan areas across the South, including Charlotte, and found that reported injury rates were 2 to 5 times greater than what appears in the federal statistics. The survey, part of a report called Build a Better South, published in 2017, only asked about injuries and included part-time workers, while the federal data counted both injuries and illnesses and examined full-time equivalents, meaning the discrepancy between the two data sets is likely even greater. Jackie Corneo, a principal investigator on the study with the Partnership for Working Families, says that workers can be too intimidated to report injuries or a safety complaint for fear of retaliation. Employers are really the ones who have the upper hand on the information that we all use to analyze the construction industry, she says. This effect is often compounded among undocumented workers, says Daniel Arroyo, who worked on the report as a field coordinator for the Workers' Defense Project. A majority of those that go unreported, it's because they are undocumented, he says. That's a lot of the information we got back. Undocumented workers often believe they will have to pay for medical expenses themselves and don't understand that workers' compensation insurance could cover them, he says. The survey distributed by Arroyo's team was anonymous, but even then, many were still too fearful to participate. Regardless of the actual direction workplace injuries have headed in recent years, labor advocates say the dramatic drop in state inspections is a recipe for trouble. There are a lot of inherent dangers on construction sites, especially in big commercial sites, Action NC's McCoy says. Any reduction in safety inspections in these places is almost certainly going to lead to problems. Whether the situation will change is another question altogether. Berry, a Republican, has served 5 terms as state labor commissioner and was supportive of having the NCOSH report on inspector retention presented to the General Assembly. But Quesenberry says it's not really that she was going down there and saying, we want to grow this agency. In the meantime, the families of workers injured or killed on the job continue to grapple with the ripple effects, and the construction is surging forward. At the Innovation District site, workers are now installing glass on 2 buildings overlooking downtown Durham. The crews have changed several times since November, and many of the workers standing around a food truck on a recent lunch break were mostly unaware of Zimmer's injury. 400 miles to the south in Atlanta, Zimmer's mother has stayed by his side, and the bills have started to pile up, according to Facebook posts and a GoFundMe page that has raised more than $20,000. Tilly, his employer, says, we just feel terrible that his life is forever changed. This article is accompanied by several graphs with information. So let me try to interpret several of these graphs for you. One is on North Carolina's growing construction industry, and it gives data from 2008 to 2016 with the total construction value of projects started by the calendar year in millions of dollars. That's in 2008, that's 19,121. And in 2016, that's 24,908. Once again, that's in millions of dollars. Whereas the construction inspections in the fiscal years from October to September in 2008 were 2,444 in 2008, and then in 2016 were only 1,105. So in the 8 years, they went from 2,444 to 1,105. Federal funding for states, including 26 state OSHA programs, started in 2005 with $91 million. And then in 2010, reached a peak at $104 million and basically have been stagnant since that time. There's a graph here that shows, a bar graph that shows construction deaths. These are state construction deaths by calendar year, according to NCOSH. So I'll give you the totals for every 2 years. So in 2008, there were 17. In 2010, 17. In 2012, 10. In 2014, 19. In 2016, there were 19. And then in 2017, there were 17. Now we turn to the executive voice page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And this week's executive voice belongs to DJ Doherty. DJ Doherty grew up in a home of entrepreneurs, so it's no surprise he jumped into the startup world early on in his career when he latched on to Parata Systems in 2003. Doherty is now CEO of the firm, which has nearly $75 million in revenue and is looking for more opportunities to grow the company, which will move into a new headquarters in a few weeks. He's also about to celebrate his 20th wedding anniversary this year, and despite having a busy schedule at Parata, Doherty says adding a fourth child, now 3 years old, was the best decision we ever made as a family. So here's the Q&A. What first brought you to Parata in 2003? When I graduated from NC State University, I had the opportunity to work for a local public accounting firm, Batchelor, Tillery, and Roberts. It was an incredibly valuable experience and chance to grow through the mentorship of Franklin Roberts. I enjoyed my job, learned a lot about professionalism and leadership, and even saw a path for advancement. However, my heart told me something was missing. I'm the product of two entrepreneurial spirits and saw firsthand what a strong work ethic can achieve. My parents, Dennis Doherty and Martha Parks, invested in and founded businesses they were passionate about. I met Doug Townsend, a founder of Townsend Frew, while working at BTR. After Doug became a founder of Parata, I heard about an open finance position there. I did some research on Parata and jumped at the opportunity. So how does Parata help pharmacies? It's important to first acknowledge a quality common to most people who seek a profession in pharmacy, and that's altruism. Everything they do on a day-to-day basis focuses on helping patients in their community lead healthier lives. Much of that time, however, is not spent operating at the highest levels of their skill, but in filling prescriptions. Our automation dramatically reduces the mundane tasks such as vial filling. We also recognize non-adherence to medication places a huge burden on healthcare costs. So for more than a decade, we've been working with pharmacies to provide automation and programs designed to increase medication adherence, such as our multi-dose pouch packaging. Patients' medications are organized by date and time of dose. It can be much easier than managing multiple vials. Our pass packs are easy to read and follow. Each pack states the medication, dose, and time of day should be taken. For a patient, this means that all the medications they should take on Friday at 8 a.m. is in one pouch. No need for lots of vials to open or use of a daily pill planner box. So where do you project the most growth going forward? Vials will be around for a long time, but we believe that pouch packaging will become more prevalent. It's so intuitive to use. It really does create better outcomes. payers are noticing that outcomes are better for patients going to certain pharmacies. Pouch packaging is showing up as a catalyst. Now, one of the largest payers has a program providing additional revenue to pharmacies offering pouch packaging from Parata for their patients. So how many employees are there? We have around 280 employees today. 5 years ago, we had roughly 380. We saw significant growth over a short period of time. Sometimes this causes management to fill function gaps with hiring sprees. A few years ago, we took a step back and contemplated how we could do things better. We were very thoughtful and structured the company to be more efficient. So how have you emphasized engagement? There's a commitment to regular, intentional conversations between manager and employee throughout the year. In the end, everyone feels a sense of ownership. Our engagement scores are the highest in the history of the company, and our retention is the highest in the history of our company. Our employee base has an average tenure of 7 years. Our executive average tenure is 10. So how's the revenue growing? Revenue for Parata in 2017 was just under $75 million. We project to steadily climb to $100 million over the next 5 years. So would the company go public? There are no plans to go public. Employees are happy, investors are happy, and we have plenty of capital to continue providing the highest level of service to our customers and innovating to solve problems now and in the future. So what was the biggest change in moving to CEO? I'm going to make a shameless plug for the Bell Leadership Institute in Chapel Hill. Through these sessions, I made tremendous advancements in my leadership skills. As Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, I worked diligently to lead my teams better, setting people up for success and facilitating group discussions to achieve ownership of solutions across all affected. Becoming CEO took this to a whole new level. And as we near the end of the broadcast, let's take a look at the viewpoint page. And the editor's notebook is entitled, "Don't Ask Me About the Market, I'm Volatile Right Now." Here we go. Wall Street's gone bonkers. By the time you read this, I'm guessing the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 may be off 2 to 3% from the February 7th close of 24,893 for the Dow Jones and 26,81 for the S&P. Given what the economy has done for the past 7 years, it's hard to imagine the volatility is reflective of the underlying stress of the economy. While pundits argue the frothiness of the tech, healthcare, and business services sectors, earnings continue to show strong bottom-line growth. Perhaps what may be more encouraging is that wages have started to go up at a noticeable pace. And that can only mean one thing: an accelerated tightening of the monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. Did that spook the market to bring in this over-the-top volatility? Or was it program trading as complex financial algorithms triggered sell-offs? The answer probably lies in the middle. For people who attended the various economic forecasts at the beginning of the year across a triangle, you may recall most of the economists painting a rosy picture for 2018 and at least half of 2019. The predictions may still hold true, but at some point this year, there will be a wide-scale sell-off for people to extract their profits. If you look at the market activity and the flow of money, there's not a widespread trend here. Yes, people may have reshuffled their 401k strategy and re-evaluated their ETFs, but they are not abandoning the market. That could only mean the marketplace continues to have more people who feel bullish about the economy. When the Commerce Department announces the first quarter GDP growth in April, that likely will give markets another boost, because the number could be as high as 5%, thanks to the robust manufacturing and construction spending. Just days ago, the Atlanta Fed estimated a 5.4% GDP growth in the first quarter. So the big question would be, what happens to the market after that? I think we have about 2 to 3 months to figure that out. But then again, my instincts are very volatile right now. This week's guest column is written by Andrew Broad, who is a senior research center fellow in the UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. It's entitled, "North Carolina Swung and It Missed Twice." The first month of 2018 brought two pieces of bad news to North Carolina. First was the announcement that a Toyota Mazda plant would locate in Alabama instead of North Carolina. Then Amazon announced its list of 20 finalists for a second North American headquarters, and the Triad wasn't on it. The Amazon news wasn't a big blow because the Triad's bid for the headquarters was such a long shot. And the fact that Raleigh made the list of finalists is good news for North Carolina. But the Toyota Mazda announcement hurt. Landing that plant would have employed a lot of people, and it would have been a great fit for the Triad. This was the second time we came in second to Alabama in a competition for a big automotive plant. In 93, Mercedes-Benz chose Alabama over a site near Mebane in Alamance County. The fact that Alabama won on the strength of a huge incentives package was a wake-up call for North Carolina, which had not been aggressive about offering incentives. And yet a quarter century of upping our game couldn't overcome the first mover advantage that Alabama made for itself back in 1993. North Carolina reportedly offered much more in incentives than Alabama for the Toyota Mazda plant, but over the last 25 years, Alabama built on its success of landing that Mercedes-Benz plant, and now boasts an automotive cluster that includes plants for Honda, Hyundai, and Toyota, as well as an extensive network of vendors and suppliers. Its automotive manufacturing sector employs about 40,000 people, many of them highly skilled. It was Alabama's established automotive cluster that allowed it to offer less, and still win the bidding. In other words, we lost out to Alabama 25 years ago because we didn't offer enough in incentives. We lost out to Alabama this month because we didn't offer enough in incentives 25 years ago. The point of this postmortem isn't to make us all feel bad, but to remind us that even with the distortion of targeted incentives, it often takes time for a region's economic investments to bear fruit. For years, experts argued that Alabama had overpaid in 93. It wasn't until the last 10 years or so when the expert consensus reversed itself. The Toyota Mazda announcement reinforces that reversal. So if Alabama can take its time and build a new industrial cluster over the course of a couple of decades, and so can North Carolina. We may not have to endure a dozen rejections, but good things come to regions that wait and make smart investments. Finally, in this week's Business Survey Pulse, the question is the cost of Super Bowl commercials worth it? And 580 responses came in, and 80% said no, and 20% said yes. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.